From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The high cost of college and student debt is facing the whole country now. New grads with loans due. Congress with federal loan interest rates having just doubled. Families and students struggling with a system that can seem designed to crush. It can all look unsustainable. The state of Oregon is thinking about a new way. Go to college tuition-free, then pay a small percentage of your earnings, whatever they may be. This hour On Point, a radical rethink on paying for college. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Would it work? Would it work for you, the Oregon plan? Do you have a better idea? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll look at the Oregon push then more widely in this hour at efforts to find our way out of the college cost and debt trap. Everybody seems to be talking about it these days. Today, yesterday, of course, in the U.S. Senate, here was Vermont Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders saying the nation is facing a major crisis with mounting college debts and federal Stafford student loan interest rates doubling on July 1st to 6.8%. He said the longer Congress waits to act on the issue, the worse their message to parents becomes.
In a competitive global economy, what we are saying to families all over this country, we do not want your kids to get a college education. We don't want them to become doctors or nurses, business people, scientists, teachers. We don't want them to expand their intellectual capability and make us a competitive nation.
Bernie Sanders of Vermont. In Oregon, they've put a new plan on the table. We're going to look at it and beyond it in this hour. Here's Oregon State Senator Mark Haas explaining the plan to allow students to attend state colleges without paying tuition, this so-called pay it forward, pay it back plan.
You go to college and you don't pay anything until you get out. And then you go to work for a big TV station and a certain percentage of your income then gets sent back to the university for, say, 20, 24 years. That's what we're looking at. And it works on kind of a revolving loan mechanism, which is really not that uncommon in public finance.
Would it work? Have you got a better idea? We're at 1-800-423-8255. With us first today from Portland, Oregon, is Nathan Hunt, a senior at Portland State University. He was a member of the student seminar that brought the idea for pay it forward, pay it back to the Oregon State Legislature. Nathan Hunt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you here. Also with us from over the border in Seattle, Washington, is John Burbank. He is executive director, founder of the Economic Opportunity Institute, the group that originally laid out the blueprints for the pay it forward push. John Burbank, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me, Tom.
Nathan Hunt, you're just wrapping up 4 years in college. How big a deal, how big an issue is this to you and your fellow students?
I think it's a really big deal. We had an opportunity to speak to a lot of folks on campus while we were doing this push towards introducing this proposal to legislators, and it was welcome and positively received by nearly everyone we pitched it to.
So what was the challenge you were trying to take on here, Nathan?
Well, it was for a course, and we wanted to take this proposal that we had found through John Burbank's report, and we wanted to propose it to legislators. We wanted to find a legislator that would actually propose it in the House, and we found one, and his name's Michael Dembro. He's a local representative here, and it went into his committee, the Higher Ed Committee, and it got signed into law. I don't think any of us expected it to move this fast.
Was it unanimous in both houses of the legislature?
That's what I heard, yeah.
But it's not a done deal yet. What they've really agreed to is to look at it, consider it, and if they like what they see upon more examination, put forward a pilot program in 2015 or so, Nathan?
Absolutely.
What are you hoping this would accomplish? If you would, well, maybe first explain it to us in your own words. We'll hear from John, but how would you explain to people around the country what you've got on the table here, Nathan?
Well, even though it's in the hands of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission now, what we proposed was very similar to Burbank's plan, that students would not have to pay anything up front on the tuition fees portion of college expense. What they would do is sign a binding agreement with the state of Oregon to pay the state a certain percentage of their gross income for a set period of time after graduation. Now, even if they don't complete school, they'll accrue a percentage to pay the state off of their gross income throughout their attendance.
Okay. John, what kind of percentage does this plan envision over what period of time of graduates' earnings?
So the Oregon legislation envisions a 3% of adjusted gross income over a 24-year period of time. Of course, that is variable depending upon the cost of tuition that is being replaced over time. And so it will have different iterations for each of the states that wants to consider this pay it forward idea.
So if you make a little, 3% would be little. If you make a lot, if you're Bill Gates, 3% would be a lot.
Absolutely. And that's the whole point, is that we would like to build a higher education trust fund that then enables the next generational cohort of students the same debt-free access to higher education.
What's the advantage for students here, Nathan? You're still going to have to pay something after you graduate for a long time.
I think the idea is access. Even when kids are approaching college, when they're in high school, they see that the door is wide open. You do well in high school, you cross the road, you go to college. There's no more mystique, there's no more mystery, you just go. There's not interest that's going to be accruing on a principal amount, so it never runs away from you. If you have trouble finding a high-paying job, you can manage your payment to the state. If you have a high-paying job, you have no problems managing your payment to the state.
John, how do you picture... I mean, how does 3% of earnings compare to what students would likely pay in loans under the current system in Oregon or anywhere else?
Oh, it is much, much less and much more manageable. So, for example, if you come out of school and your first job, you're making $30,000, 3% of that is $900. So you're looking at something that is less than your cell phone bill per month. So this is, and that is the point, is that we want to make this manageable so graduates and new graduates can get on with their lives in terms of taking on responsibilities such as paying for their own rent or buying a house or paying childcare for their children or establishing their own 401k accounts for their own retirement. Right now, debt is impinging on all those other factors. And so it is a real ball and chain around the ankles of recent graduates.
Less than your cell phone bill, because you're talking $900 a year here if it were 3% of a $30,000 income right out of school. How do you finance Oregon State University's right out of the gate with a program like this? If all of a sudden you've got, you know, all your students not paying tuition, what keeps the gas in the tank?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important you've sort of put your finger on one of the things that we have to work out is which are the transition costs. And what Oregon needs to develop and what we in Washington are also developing is how we fund those the transition costs. Oregon actually will have a bond that will go to the people in November for education. And so part of the costs of Pay It Forward can be funded through this bond, assuming that it passed. So Oregon has a unique instrument that will enable it to move forward quite quickly with the actual implementation of Pay It Forward. Other states need to figure out other avenues for enabling the implementation of Pay It Forward.
Is this really going to change the amount students pay in toto for their college education, or does it just stretch it out, John?
Oh, it absolutely changes the amount, and it's a paradigm shift in terms of how we understand college education. So right now, if you're a high school senior with your parents and you're looking at, for example, going to the University of Washington, and all of a sudden you realize that you have a $13,000 tuition bill and your family income is $70,000, wow, that is a big, big bite on your family income, and you're not going to get any sort of low income aid either. So instead, you're able to go to the University of Washington tuition free. And then you know that when you graduate, you will be contributing for a predetermined number of years at a predetermined percent of your income. And that's completely manageable. So yeah, it really frees you up in terms of the ability not just to go to college, but then to pursue the career that you want to pursue when you graduate from college.
Because you're going to pay a percentage of your income, you don't have to go just for the money. I mean, it can sound pretty appealing. On the other hand, this is just about tuition and fees, right? There are a lot of other costs attendant to college, room and board and all the rest. If kids still have to borrow to cover those, could they come out with an obligation to the state of Oregon plus student loans after 4 years, John?
Yes, that is a possibility. That's why it's very, very important to maintain financial aid for low-income students, Pell Grants, et cetera, because we need to make sure that the room and board are taken care of as well. But this is targeted to tuition, and tuition has been the culprit in the last 15 years in terms of college education. States have underfunded and are defunding public higher education that's been replaced with tuition on the students and their families, and that has been financed through this incredible escalation of student debt. And Nathan, this is something that we can bring an end to.
Nathan, we'll see where this goes, but what about you and your fellow students? Can you believe what you've launched here and got up on the rails, on the table in Oregon?
We're still getting used to it. The timing of it with the doubling of the interest rates on loans was incredible timing. Couldn't have planned for that. And it's, I don't think anyone expected this to be getting the attention it was getting back in last fall. It just was something that's blowing us away, but we're happy to have the attention.
You're going to graduate soon. Do you wish this would have been available to you, Nathan?
I would have taken it in a minute. I would have not even had to think about it.
Nathan Hunt, he is a senior at Portland State University. He was in the seminar that grabbed onto this plan, put it in front of the Oregon State Legislature. Now it is there for maybe a pilot project in 2015, and it's getting a lot of national attention at a time when the whole country is saying, where do we go with the costs of college and student debt? Nathan Hunt in Portland, Oregon, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Talking this hour about a radical rethink on paying for college in Oregon and moves around the country to rethink how we structure and pay for higher education. Oregon's just taken a step. Others are thinking about what to do all over the place. There are critics of this plan. We're going to hear from one big one in just a moment here. John Burbank is with us from Seattle, Washington. He's executive director at the Economic Opportunity Institute in Seattle. They first put the kind of blueprint for this together. John, we've got listeners with questions and comments aplenty here. Let me bring on Jeff in Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I find it interesting. We always hear of American exceptionalism, yet the two areas we seem to fail miserably are in health and education. But just look at Australia, and it's one of the countries in the world that seems to, in many ways, be most like us, and yet what do they have? They have, number one, national health care. That's another issue. But
yep.
They also have this program. They have higher education loans to students to go to university that they pay off over time as a percent of their income, and they even have it nuanced to where, depending on the type of job you get, you pay a certain percentage. Teachers pay a bit less, bankers pay a bit more.
Wow, so they're already there in Australia, ahead of Oregon.
It's working, yes.
And what do you think of it for the U.S., Jeff? Would you applaud more states picking this up here, Oregon really going through with it?
I have a son starting college in 2 years. I'm all for it.
Yeah, you and a whole lot of other parents, maybe. John Burbank, is that the fact? Australia's already done it? How's it working?
Oh, yes. Australia has a similar concept, as does the UK. There is one important difference between what is being proposed in Oregon and in several other states around our country and the Australian program is that the Australian program is geared toward individual debt. So it does have an income-based repayment system based upon your tuition, but our program is really not a debt instrument. So you get access to higher education,
yeah.
And then after graduation, you contribute 3% of your income for 24 years. In Oregon's case, the point is that our program, you're developing a higher education trust fund that enables the next cohort of students the same access. So you're not paying off your individual debt. You're paying forward to enable the next generational cohort the same educational access that you had when you went to college through Pay It Forward.
You're really getting people's attention here. Curtis in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Curtis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is just transferring costs to the states who are really already broke. Colleges have no incentive or penalty based around the education they provided. So in other words, they have these huge endowments, tuition keeps going up, and the jobs aren't there. So instead, if the students can't get the jobs, then the student loans should be mitigated. Say, for example, 25% reduction in the overall student loan for every year that they don't have a job that in the field that they were educated in.
That would build a fire under a lot of people, but it could also end up, well, that could sink the state too. But I take your point about where do costs go here. And Curtis, I appreciate your call. John, what about it? Curtis says, you know, you're just dumping this back on the college, the state, university, therefore the state. Is it really sustainable in that way? Or are you dumping it onto the student? Because I assume this percentage of income that's required would be kind of a floating rate if necessary to cover costs.
No, that's not correct. Okay. When a student would graduate, they would have a predetermined rate of income for a predetermined number of years. Think about this from the aspect. Yes, fixed rate.
Okay.
Think about this from the aspect of a student in high school who's thinking about going to college, and they face these huge both financial and psychological sticker price barriers to going to college. This actually sort of smashes down those barriers and enables that student to go to college. But I think what Curtis is alluding to is the fact that states have been underfunding and defunding public education over the last 15 years, so that tuition has replaced that funding right now. So tuition is essentially a tax that replaces what should have come from general funds from state government.
But so it didn't come because so many of them are so strapped and have been.
Well, you know, we're coming out of the recession. There's been a turnaround. You look at California, and there's actually a surplus, and there's new funding for higher education. It's not a question of not having enough national income. It's a question of who has the income and how we make sure that we appropriately fund public higher education. And I think that pay it forward is actually an interesting lever for that, because it actually if we use this accretion model of gradually bringing more and more students in, it will only be feasible if tuition is held steady or actually decreased, which means that we need to think about how we refund public higher education in our country.
If Oregon goes through with this, what about out-of-state students? Are you going to have them lined up for miles at the state borders? Would it work for out-of-state matriculants as well?
That's a great question, and we really haven't figured out how to deal with that yet. I think what is more interesting is that you're going to have a waiting list of in-state students who want to get on to pay it forward, and that creates a political dynamic that will help, I think, find the public resources for refunding public higher education.
Dave,
this goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Well, paying forward goes hand in hand. Both the contributions from the graduates goes hand in hand with increased commitment from the states for publicly funding public higher education.
Dave in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What do you think, Dave?
Oh, hi. I think it's wonderful that people are thinking outside the box, and I know that the cost of college is very backbreaking. But what worries me is that this will become a form of student welfare. And so people who hold on blue-collar jobs and don't go to college end up paying for, let's say me, I go to college, I have a great time. I go to school for maybe 5 or 6 years. I get out, and maybe I open up a comic book store. And so therefore, I've accrued a lot more debt and a lot more expense to the taxpayers of the state. And then I kind of take a slacker job. And there is a, you know, there's a talk about you know, the failure to launch generation, and this just seems like a perfect opportunity for people to take advantage of the system.
Oh boy!
So I applaud the thinking.
Yeah,
and I'll take the comments off the air.
Okay, Dave, we got it. John, how about it? You're going to launch a generation of slackers here. Who? Hey, I'm only going to pay 3% of whatever. So
first,
open a comic book store.
First of all, I don't think that Americans are slackers, and I don't think American students are slackers. And secondly, I think the gentleman is a little bit wrong, because what's happening is that these graduates are creating a public higher education trust fund to enable the next generation of students the same access that they had. So this is something that actually it is a paradigm shift. It is outside the box. But what it does is it opens up higher education to many, many, many thousands and millions of more high school students across the board. And I want to emphasize one thing is that this is not just about four-year colleges. This is also about community colleges, and this is about workforce training. And the way that Oregon has planned this and that we have planned this is that you can slice and dice these contributions. So if you were to, say, go to college for 2 years and then drop out, then you would be responsible for half of 1.5% of your income as a contribution for the Pay It Forward program. So I think that sort of may be a discouragement to slackers as well.
And would there be a minimum repayment, or if I just, you know, go build a hut in the woods and don't even get a job, that's it?
Well, actually, a Vermont legislator brought up this and it, in acknowledgement that sometimes the first 2 or 3 years after college students are graduates are moving around, they may be traveling, they may be in AmeriCorps, they may be in Teach for America. And so maybe that's not the best time to start this program. Now, student loans, as you know, you only have a 6 months grace period.
Yeah.
What we're talking about, we're thinking about is how about if this kicks in at age 25? In the short run, that means a drop in cash flow into the Public Higher Education Trust Fund. But in the long run, it means actually a more robust trust fund because your earnings at ages 46, 47, 48 are going to be far greater than your earnings immediately after college. So there are a lot of different ways we can handle this and that we can sort of work around some of the problems that have been brought up. But the idea about this is that we like to see these problems as not problems that stand in the way of making this work, but rather problems that can be worked around and resolved so that we can move forward with this paradigm shift in public higher education in our country.
Interesting. Oregon, looking at no tuition, then you pay 3% of earnings for 24 years. John Burbank, stand by in Seattle, Washington. I want to bring on a kind of professional assessor of what you've got up on the rails here one way or another. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb joins us now from Madison, Wisconsin. She's Associate Professor of Educational Policy Studies and Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me to be part of this long overdue discussion, Tom.
Listen, we've talked about this a lot because we hear from so many students and their families about the burden that's being put on them in our current system. I know you're really concerned about it and have thought and written about it a lot, but you're not a fan of the Oregon initiative here. Why not, Sarah?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I completely share the concerns of these students and these advocates working so hard to come up with a solution. I've spent the last 5 years following Pell recipients, watching them struggle. We must do something. That is absolutely something that everybody here agrees on. What we don't agree on is this particular strategy. And I think that's mainly because I agree with some of your callers who note that the reason we're in this mess has to do with the behavior of states and institutions of higher education and how they have failed to support the federal government's efforts over the last 40 years to make college affordable. They've undermined our efforts with federal financial aid in many, many ways. And what this program does is rather than address that issue really head on, essentially it charges students with the task of paying for future students. It asks the state to be nice and continue to contribute, but it does nothing to ensure that that will happen.
What you see this as a way for states, Oregon maybe first of all, to offload state contributions to higher education? How? Why, Sarah?
That's exactly what I'm saying, quite frankly, and I know it's cynical, but Oregon gives us every reason to think that's exactly what's happening. If you look at the news from Oregon up until this most recent week, not everyone's been following higher education there, but if you look, you will see that Oregon has been taking steps to steadily privatize its public universities. In fact, it has worked to grant them additional autonomy, which typically in this country means they get to be in control of their finances while receiving even less support from the state. It's a model that began in Virginia with the University of Virginia, and the result has been that state support to the University of Virginia has declined dramatically over time. This is not a state with a good track record of well-intentioned moves towards public institutions.
This is a state that
is doing the exact opposite.
But let me ask you, I mean, John says, look, it would be a fixed percentage of your earnings that you'd pay back over time. So the state could try to offload costs here, but if I'm only going to pay 3%, it's never going to grow. There's only so much they can
dump on me if I'm a graduate. Isn't that some kind of guarantee of balance of inputs here, Sarah?
It would seem that way, and I understand why it, on the face of it, it looks that way. The first thing that we have to return to is the conversation you were having earlier about the other costs of attendance. Tuition and fees are only 40% of the total bill these students are facing. That's the first thing you have to know. The vast majority of them do not receive Pell Grants and therefore borrow to cover those other costs. They will very likely, I disagree with John on this, they will very likely continue to borrow. They will therefore graduate with debt on top of this repayment.
John, is this a backdoor way to dump more of the cost of state higher education on students, John?
No, I think although I agree with Sarah that we're witnessing the public disinvestment in public higher education that has been done by the states, and that is something that our organization has been working to try to remedy over the last 15 years. This actually creates a lever to demand more public funding for public higher education. And the reason is that the way the Oregon model is suggesting is a pilot program, and that's a model that we're developing in our state as well, and that will be developed in other states as well. And when you have a pilot program like this, you're going to have a waiting list of students who want to get on this. And once you create a waiting list, then you're going to have the public demand that the state reinvest in public higher education. And in fact, if we want Pay It Forward to cover more and more students over time, then it's important that tuition be stable or actually decrease over time. And the only way that's going to happen is if the the states reinvest in public higher education. The other thing that to keep in mind is just like the GI Bill after World War II, when we had this incredible influx of soldiers coming in, taking advantage of the GI Bill and going to school, we had this tremendous development of an infrastructure of public higher education. When you put Pay It Forward in place, you're going to have more and more people who decide, yes, I can get higher education. There's going to be increased demand, and that means there's going to have to be much more public investment in infrastructure, in professors, in buildings to open the doors of higher education to millions of more students.
Susan in Springfield, Illinois. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been talking with my daughter this morning, and our suggestion is that the businesses participate in this and maybe pay 1.5% back. I don't know if they would do it on a monthly basis or salary or at the end of a year, make a donation.
You mean if they hire an Oregon graduate in this case, then they would kick in as well, kind of a matching contribution or something?
Yes, because they're the ones that are requiring the actual degree.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so if they're asking for that, and most of the time, beginning people are starting out not making a whole lot of money anyway.
Yeah.
And they're
Susan, our time is short before the break. Forgive me here, but what about that's, John? That's a, I mean, that, well, just that, hiring that's a, your graduates is going to help the state out in this case. What about?
Well, it's a very interesting idea, and there's always already a precedent for that. And what that is, Social Security, in which employees pay 6.2% and businesses pay 6.2%. So that's something that we should consider, how that could be wrapped into financing this future higher education trust fund. I think that the whole goal about this is that we are in a crisis. It is unsustainable. We need to figure out how to resolve this and create a new paradigm shift. And that's what we're trying to do with Pay It Forward. And we understand that there's a lot of kinks that need to be worked out, and we're happy to work those kinks out.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, there's more we want to learn from you. Please stand by in Madison, Wisconsin. John Burbank in Seattle at the Economic Opportunity Institute. We appreciate you being with us this hour, John. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a radical rethink on paying for college in Oregon and moves around the country to rethink how we structure and pay for higher education. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Sarah, lots of response online here. Jane says, you know, hey, We should value higher education, but 3% for 25 years seems a bit stiff, even if a college education is a privilege. Tim says, well, it would give the universities an incentive to help you succeed beyond graduation. That seems quite true. They would be motivated, invested in you getting a job. Molly says public colleges have become ridiculously expensive. And I want to bring this one to you, Sarah. Josh says, restructured debt scheduling is not radical, looking at the Oregon plan. Debt's the norm. The opposite of debt would be radical. What would be really radical would be an allocation of public funding to public higher education to educate the public for the public good without them going into private debt. Can we afford that, Sarah?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I completely agree with that writer. I think that a lot of people want us to believe that we can't afford that and therefore we can't demand that. I don't think that's true. I think the fact is that we can't do that at the individual state level. And this isn't going to be a problem that individual states are going to solve themselves.
Okay.
This is going to be resolved through a partnership with the federal government, which frankly is an enormously large player in higher education today and can play a serious role in getting this done.
But with all the talk about federal deficits, where do you see the spare change to, are you suggesting make higher education free?
I am actually suggesting we take the existing money that we are already spending and use it to ensure that we make states and institutions work in accordance with federal goals in order to receive federal funds. We spend an enormous amount of money through Title IV, which is the financial aid program that facilitates those loans and facilitates those Pell Grants. I put out a proposal in the last month that describes a reallocation that actually goes to institutions in order to drive down tuition and fees, but requires states to cooperate with those institutions in order for the institutions to get the money.
But what does that mean? Are you going to have to remake university education to drive down costs to make that work, Sarah?
Are we going to have to remake university education? Well, I think that depends on how you define university education. A lot of university education, frankly, has gotten really far away from the educational experiences of our parents and grandparents. The education today focuses enormously on the social rather than the academic. And that may sound odd from a professor, but I live this and I watch it every day and I study it. And if you look at where the allocations are going today, they're not actually going very often to support students' academic success. We can do more to focus our efforts so that we can provide a high-quality post-secondary education to more people without asking them to repay for 24 years.
Sarah, stand by there in Madison. I want to bring another perspective into this conversation from Washington. Jeff Salingo joins us. He's editor-at-large at the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. He's looking at lots of radical and less radical ideas for changing the system. Jeff Salingo, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Tom.
We want to look at some of the big pushes that you're describing in College Unbound, but let me just first get your reaction to the Oregon plan. Does it look practical to you? Do you think it's ever going to become a reality? Would it work for other states?
I think there's a lot of problems with it. I agree with some of the other callers and Sarah on this. For one thing, I think I definitely agree with her that it doesn't ensure that Oregon is going to continue to contribute to its higher education system in the future. It doesn't address the cost side of the equation. In other words, what will Oregon institutions do in order to try to keep down their costs going into the future? I also think that students need to have some skin in the game while they're in college, and it's unclear where that's going to come into being. And more so, I'm a little worried about who we're trying to solve the problem for here. You know, Sarah talks a lot about low-income students, and I'm, like her, most worried about them because that's going to be increasingly the number of students coming to college in the next 10 years. You know, we're becoming a much more diverse nation.
What do you mean by diverse in that sentence?
In terms of we are going to have more students of color coming to college campuses in the next 10 years, given the demographic shifts in this country, and they're going to be first-generation students, they're going to be poorer students. And so let's even look today at a place like the University of Oregon, where somebody making over $110,000 in Oregon pays about $19,000. That's their net tuition price at the University of Oregon. And somebody making under $50,000 pays about $12,000. So there's only about a $7,000 difference between somebody in some of the lowest income brackets in Oregon and people in the highest income brackets.
But this Oregon plan is being put forward as something that would work for low-income students, but because there'd be no upfront costs and it would just be 3% of whatever they made.
Right, but what we should really be focusing on is lowering the net cost for those students in the lowest income, in the lowest income brackets. And I'm not quite sure that by just pushing off the paying for college 10, 20 years down the road, that we're necessarily going to help those students where we can in other ways.
You talk about skin in the game. Are you suggesting that without the gun of big debt to new graduates' heads or students' heads, they don't have skin in the game? I mean, after all, it's their education, it's their future.
Well, I'm not quite sure that we're talking about big debt here. I mean, the thing about debt...
We are now. I think that's the current motivation, as I hear you.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at a place like the University of Oregon, the average student, the average graduate there pays about $230 in student loans. So their yearly debt, that includes not only the debt, the principal, but interest, is about $2,700 or so. That to me, is fairly reasonable. I think the problem with debt in this student debt in this country are students who take on way too much debt. And I think the stories in the media and the stories that I even like to tell are the ones who do take on, you know, $100,000+ of debt for undergraduates, but that's very few students who actually do that. You know, the average debt now for the class of 2013 was around $30,000. And I think that students need to take on some debt in order to kind of motivate them for going to college.
Sarah, 30K average debt, no big deal nationally. And it's a kind of motivation for students. What do you say to that, Sarah?
Well, this is an area in which Jeff knows that we disagree. I don't pretend to think that $30,000 that has to be paid off, you know, 15% of that a year or whatever, sometimes more, is a reasonable thing to ask, especially for students making $30,000 a year or who are unemployed. It's obviously a hardship. I do not think there is any evidence whatsoever that paying more money makes students more motivated to finish college, or that the problem that we have today with college completion rates has anything to do with student motivation. There are plenty of other reasons why college completion rates aren't what they ought to be. But I really want to note, the fact is that the college completion rate in Oregon is 50% over 6 years. This will not be 3% for bachelor's degree recipients. It will be at minimum 4.5% because they take about 6 years, as I said, to finish.
And the longer you're around, the higher you'd have to pay. Okay, right, right. Maybe that's a motivation to get in and get it done. Wilbur in Nashville, Tennessee. Wilbur, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As a student, I'm about to be a sophomore at UT, and as a student, I view this as a very good opportunity. But my, like, worldly view concern would be that this kind of seems as a backup plan for, like, not being able to pay debt. And to me, debt, not, it's almost like they're saying an incentive. If you have a higher debt, it's an incentive to make more money and pay it off. But I think if there's a predetermined rate and a predetermined yearly amount, then it doesn't necessarily make someone want to earn more. And if they don't get the job that they were initially thinking that they would get, or the salary that they thought they were going to get, that they might not necessarily be able to pay what the university was originally intending.
Wilbur, I hear you, but let me just test you on that. I mean, a couple more years, you get out of college. Let's say you're under this 3% a year plan for 24 years. Aren't you going to want to make the best income you can come up with? You know?
Yes, definitely. I would, everyone would strive to make the best, but If they aren't meeting what they originally intended, I don't know that they'll be able to pay the money back.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the better scenario is you don't make what you're intending and you're just sitting there with that student loan and it's eating your guts out. I don't know. There's issues both ways. But I appreciate your call, Wilbur. Thank you very much. In Nashville, one from Omaha here, Nebraska. Jim is on the air. Hi, Jim. You're on.
Hey, Tom, I have a question for your guests.
Yeah.
The number of applicants to your state institutions is going to balloon. How would you decide who gets to go and who doesn't? Would it be entrance exams or economics or minorities or what?
If Oregon goes through with it, let's just test that presumption. Sarah, do you think that with this no money down scenario, if they could put it together, if they could pull it off, do you think you'd see exploding application numbers for their state universities?
That is such a great point, and I think your guest is right on to think about the reaction of the institutions to that. I think that what John was asserting was that the number of people who would want into the system would grow, and so the state would invest to make more spots. I think we'll see the opposite. Institutions like it when more people apply and they get to turn them away. It helps them raise their U.S. News rankings.
Look how
desirable
we are.
Because that is their admission rate.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. They get to become more selective.
But that shouldn't
so
be a state university's incentive, should it? A state university shouldn't have
that. You know, unfortunately, the state universities are in the same darn race. And they have behaved as if they were competing with the private institutions all along. They would love to see their selectivity grow. So I don't think that they'll make more spaces for them. I think, in fact, they will find other ways to sift and winnow their way through these students. And it will not be nearly as democratizing as we want to see because, frankly, there is no stick in here to make sure that their response is to open their doors.
So watch out. You've got to keep an eye on these things every step of the way. Justin in Salem, New Hampshire. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi. I just got done with my associate's degree, paying that off right now, trying to move forward my bachelor's degree while working a full-time career and a part-time job on the side.
Busy man.
And, yeah, busy. And my career wants me to keep moving forward with the company to get my bachelor's, but in this economy right now and everything with the loans and the school interest, it's just really hard to get back in the game because I can't defer my associate's loan and I'm still trying to pursue my bachelor's career.
Yeah.
So the 3% looks like a good option right now, but I don't think it's a long-term fix.
So how far are you going to go? And will you look at will you have a big debt bill when you get out, Justin?
I'll have a huge debt bill. I mean, to do my career, to go where they want me to go in the company, they need my master's degree, if not my PhD. So to keep moving forward, it will be over $150,000. And all done and said with, and it's like, where's the money going? Like, the schools, the quality of the school, it didn't look any better than when the pictures from the 90s, even early 2000s, like, where is this $200,000 going in the end? Where are we paying all this money to?
Justin, we wish you luck, and that's a good question. Jeff, you're looking at how people may fundamentally restructure, not just payment, but the education they're delivered. You hear our caller saying, hey, I'm paying all this money, so much more than in the past, and it doesn't look like college education is so different. Where is it going? What are some ideas that you're finding out there for change beyond just the repayment schemes, Jeff?
So a lot of it is around the delivery of higher education. And you know, I don't think we're going to see the mass closings of traditional colleges and universities in the next 10 or 20 years, but I think that we're going to see the emergence of some new and different models, or different models at least, including things like, you know, competency-based education, you know, three traditional universities, including Sarah's University of Wisconsin System, Northern Arizona, and Southern New Hampshire are testing this idea.
What is the idea?
This year, and this is ideas where you base learning on what a student knows rather than how much time they spend in a seat. So right now, the bachelor's degree is based on 120 credits. You know, you take 3 credits for most classes. They meet 14, 15, 16 weeks, whether you know the information or not. You have to sit in that class to earn that credit. And so competency-based is kind of turns that on its head and basically says, okay, if you already know this, you move on and you focus on what you don't know. I think then there's also injections of technology. You know, we're seeing some good experiments right now with hybrid education. I don't think that online
meaning online and physical
and in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I do not think that online education only or online only is the answer, especially for, you know, what we think of as traditional 18-year-olds going to college. They don't want it. They're not mature enough. I think there's a lot of other pieces of college that students get in the classroom and outside the classroom that require face-to-face interaction. But I think that using injections of technology could help on the cost side and on the efficiency side, and in some cases improve student learning outcomes at the same time.
Sarah, do you see radical change coming? We get it that you would like to see more state-federal investment here. But what about the structure of universities themselves? Do you see radical change coming?
I absolutely do. And I think that one of the most important questions that's raised about this energy around the Oregon proposal is whether focusing so much on simply a model that asks students to really basically pay this themselves over time, that really privatizes things, distracts from the energy that we need in order to get that radical change to occur. Universities are under pressure to alter the way in which they fund and structure higher education, and the federal government is under tremendous pressure. We're coming up on a reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. There are lots of discussions of reform. I recently hosted a huge conference. It was on C-SPAN at the American Enterprise Institute. We were all talking about changes. This is a major conversation, and I'm so glad you're having a program on it so that people can hear more about what else is possible.
There are a lot of students and a lot of families and a lot of graduates and people dreaming of more education who need something done here. Oregon has got people talking. There's much more to be said, and we will stay on it. I'm very grateful to the two of you for helping us look at this today. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us from Madison today. Sarah, thanks so much for your time and insights.
Thank you.
And Jeff Salingo, editor-at-large at the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of College Unbound, The Future of Higher Education and What It Means for Students. Jeff, you're terrific. Thanks for being with us today.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
Listeners, tomorrow we are going to hear from Edward Snowden in his own words. We'll listen to Snowden's account of what he's up to, and we will look in on the race, kind of global race, between asylum for Snowden and prosecution of Snowden. Join us for that. On Point is produced by Emily Alphen Johnson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Abigail Collins, Dori Rubar, and Imogene Weinstein, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.